Coming up today, London's tech scene is growing faster than ever, but how much of that is down to government? And Apple has some news and a new music service, but is anyone listening? All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from audible apples to quasi-governmental autonomous tech facilitators. I'm your host, Michael Rundle, and I'm editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Leanne Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
Morning, everybody.
Good morning, Michael.
I'm afraid this week there is no joke. It turns out 4 weeks in a row is all it takes to exhaust the internet's store of jokes about technology.
I did think that quasi-governmental autonomous tech facilitators was almost a bit of a joke.
Sort of a poem, really, isn't it? More than a joke. It's a thinker.
Yeah.
It's a little bit Stuart Lee. But, you know, I'll try my hardest to get one for next week. If anyone does have any suggestions, feel free to write in. But if you Google tech jokes on your own and look at the wasteland that is humor based on science and technology, you'll understand my predicament, I think.
You mean you've not been coming up with them yourself?
No, I've been coming up, but it's very much in the delivery, I think. As a performer, you know, my input is largely through my voice and my tone.
Yeah. Delivery. Intonation.
I have a team of writers, obviously, but
they
haven't
been up for...
Well, yeah.
True. Sorry for the jokes, guys.
So really, it's your fault. Anyway, hopefully we'll find some humour as well as some tech news in this week's podcast, even if it's not in the form of a knock-knock joke. Anyway, let's get on with the news. So anyone who strolls around London knows that there are certain industries which are growing very quickly: financial services, speculative real estate investment, and also technology. So for anyone who doesn't know about the true scale of that, in 2010, the total amount of funding raised by London tech firms was less than £10 million. So far in 2015, it's close to £1 billion.
Wow. That sounds impressive.
It is impressive.
For us, anyway.
But the question is, whose responsibility is that? So there is an organisation known as Tech City UK, which is a publicly funded organisation to the tune of £2 million a year, which exists to promote and mediate between government and tech businesses, both in London and the rest of the UK. And this week, Wired has an exclusive interview with the CEO, Gerard Gretsch, which is worth reading. It's on our website now. And
you grilled him.
I don't know if that's accurate.
I'd say you grilled him.
Well, the interesting thing with Tech City, it attracts a huge amount of criticism from some very specific portions of the press, both for, in principle, being a publicly funded organisation and whether, you know, that is something that tech really needs, given that there's a huge amount of funding and lots of people with a lot of expertise already to do that job, but also for specifically what it does. It's been known in the past for holding a lot of parties and drinks meetings at Number 10 and Buckingham Palace in one notorious case, but whether or not actually it contributes meaningfully to tech is somewhat more up for debate. And also, obviously, being in East London, there's a certain element of how embedded is this within the wider community of Tower Hamlets. I live in Tower Hamlets. It's one of the most poor boroughs in certain specific areas in the country, and tech maybe necessarily hasn't bled over its wealth into that area. So we kind of talked about all of those issues.
That's something that happens all over the country and with every sector, though, a lot of the time when there's new industry, new expertise coming in. So I feel like blaming them for that. They should do more good. But, you know, in general, they're trying.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, to some extent, one of our conclusions, if you can call it that. I mean, we wrote it as a Q&A rather than as a feature. But you know, it's a £2 million organisation. That's not a lot of money. The problems of Tower Hamlets reach very deep. And to its credit, I think in the last couple of years, it has responded to some of that criticism. So it now runs an academy, which provides free training, online help to wannabe entrepreneurs. They claim 14,000 applications in the last 5 months. And a lot of those are coming from people who are local to London, particularly young people. Actually, during the interview, I had to sit and awkwardly watch a video on a laptop with the CEO, Gerard Gretsch, which kind of made some of these points, which wasn't particularly, it was an awkward situation, but...
thrilling. Was that his reply to one of your grilling questions?
No, but I mean, it would
Unless
be quite a good statement.
And watch this.
I've prepared this video in case you address this question.
But I mean, you know, there are some specific criticisms that Gerald answered in the interview. One of those is that this year it was found that Tech City, it has the power to issue 200 visas to exceptional entrepreneurs and tech talent per year. And last year it managed to hand out, I think, 9 of them.
Wow.
Based on, I think, only 10 applications. But
so what's his argument for that? Because that's pretty
well, the argument is that 200 is a cap. And their whole point is to hand them out to exceptional people.
So there's only 9 exceptional people.
Well, I mean, he described them as Oscar winners. And I think that's where they're coming from with it, that it's really people of a world class who they can attract. The counter criticism to that is, how well was this promoted? How well did they go out and try and find these people?
But then the question is, they've got $2 million a year and they're supposed to support the local community, promote business, run these programs, launch a PR campaign. So, I mean, they have to do a lot with a little.
That's true.
In although, their defense.
Yeah, I mean, the extent to which they get help from private businesses to do those things complicates that. So, you know, the total cost of their programs might be more than £2 million. It's just the £2 million is the amount they get from government. But, you know, so obviously it has wider aspirations. And then that's one of the other arguments against it, that there are plenty of people who would be prepared to fund, arguably, perhaps, an organisation that does similar things rather than government.
Who would you fund then? But I mean, it's like everyone has these arguments, but I don't see it being a bad thing that they exist as a mediator to, you know, and as a public voice for the sector. And yeah, there has been a lot of change since they launched. I'm not saying that's down to them, but it can't hurt.
No, I mean, I think there are people who see Tech City as taking credit for the expansion in London's tech scene. In our interview, he didn't say that. I think obviously they would be proud and want to promote their work, but I don't think they're claiming sole responsibility. But you're right. I mean, there has been a lot of change in the tech community, and there's going to be a lot of change over the next 5 years. So one of the specific things we talked about was why their position politically might be complicated by the aspirations of the new government, because they have just recently announced plans on encryption, which have been, I think it's fair to say, pretty negatively received by tech businesses, some of whom in the UK have said they will consider leaving the country if this stuff goes through, because encryption is so much a fundamental part of security businesses and other types of tech businesses. The EU referendum is coming up. Tech City UK and Gerald himself are specifically against the UK leaving the EU. But obviously they're now mediating and seem to be very close to a government and a party who are leading that effort, whether willingly or not, or based on the pressure of backbenchers or not. And then you also have data and surveillance, which again is a big thing that the tech community traditionally has come out against. Although at the same juncture, we saw before the election, roughly 100 tech businesses come out and sign a letter in support of the Conservative Party. So, you know, it's complicated. It's not a simple case of tech being on one side and government being on the other. It's a little bit more tricky, but the role of mediating between those two, I think arguably will be more important in the next 5 years than it was in the last.
I was going to say, then now going forward, it's more important than ever to have a mediator, whether or not, you know, they're aligned with a particular government, but at a time when business is coming out and saying, you know, we're going to leave the country for this, you need a voice that's going to perhaps pass those concerns on in a way that makes an impact to the government when they're making these decisions.
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly true that there are people who have that access naturally because of the types of circles they move in, or the wealth they have, or the friends they have. And separately, the people who don't have that kind of access, who might be younger entrepreneurs or first-time investors, or people who are really just starting a company on their own with their friends rather than because they have the benefit of large-scale venture capital backing and don't have that access. And so, you know, you're right. I think there is an argument for having an organization like that. Whether or not specifically you think Tech City UK has done a good job at that over the last 5 years is somewhat up to you. And obviously, I think there are people who vehemently think that they haven't done a good job, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from those people in response to the interview. I think we, you know, in the interview, we try to be neutral and kind of give both sides some space. But, you know, it's going to be an interesting time, I think, for Tech City and for tech in the city. And I think that's the wider point, that, you know, tech is growing in London, it's growing elsewhere in the UK, but by comparison to Silicon Valley, we're still nowhere. So £1 billion over the last 6 months sounds like a lot. But in comparison to Silicon Valley, that only puts us on a par with, I think, is it Redstone in California, which...
Which
is a population of 76,000. I mean, it happens to have Evernote based there and some other companies. But
Microsoft got.
But, you know, Uber raised $3 billion last year. That's more than we're going to raise this year as a city. So, you know, there's still more we can do.
I also think that there's a problem here, not just in terms of attracting tech talent, but attracting the right venture capitalists over here as well, and trying to persuade them to look beyond Silicon Valley as a place that they want to invest. And I know that Google Ventures has started to make some investments over here and a couple of the other big venture capitalist firms. But I think in terms of making sure the environment is right for them is also going to be as important as making sure the environment is right for the entrepreneurs themselves.
And making sure that London is still at the top of that list in Europe compared to Berlin. And you know, Berlin's tech sector is smaller than London's, but it's growing very quickly. And in the context of a potential exit from the EU, that situation could change. And so Tech City's got the responsibility there to promote London, but also work out its place within the context of Europe and North America. So, you know, it's interesting times, but it'll be interesting to see what happens to Tech City UK. There were some obviously questions about whether it would still be around if Labour won the election. That didn't happen, obviously. So it seems like for now that the existence of Tech City UK is secure. It's just how it transitions both to look beyond London and how it works within this kind of changing political landscape. Anyway, so the full interview is on wired.co.uk now. Check it out. So, Liat, obviously we all have smartphones in our pockets, and that goes also for people who are in desperate situations around the world where war crimes are taking place. But in the past, that footage hasn't always been admissible, but that might be about to change.
Yes, I think this is quite exciting news. We've seen for years footage of human rights abuses, war crimes, all over the world, be published online on social media, on YouTube, from people just taking a few minutes on their smartphone. The problem with that is that, like you say, traditionally it's not been admissible in court, largely because it's impossible to verify, you know, when it was taken, where it was taken, if it's actually authentic or has it been tampered with. So a new app hopes to change this, called Eyewitness to Atrocities. It's an organisation that's been set up by the International Bar Association, which represents lawyers across the globe. So it's pretty important that they're the ones behind it. They're the ones that have seen a lot of this footage fall when it comes to court cases, fall short of the mark of actually being put forward as evidence.
So is the idea that this app standardises how footage is collected and the data about that footage, so that then it can be easily compared to other footage in court? Is that roughly how it works?
Yeah, well, precisely how it works. It's basically you can film, record, or take any photos using the app, just like any other. But as soon as you start recording this footage or taking this photo, it will automatically embed in the file GPS coordinates, time and date stamp, information from sensors on the phone, all kinds of footage that can prove exactly where and when it was taken. It even can verify whether or not it's been tampered with by looking at pixel density and things like this. So all these very important for if it's actually going to be put forward as evidence. The idea is that once the footage has been taken, you can upload it to the eyewitness database where it's encrypted, and then legal experts will analyse it and work out if it can be passed on to courts around the globe. They've apparently already been in talks with the International Criminal Court and the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. That's according to a report in The Guardian. So it shows that they are very actively pursuing these relationships, which I'm sure, you know, people at the organisation already have, to ensure the links between who's using this footage and the final end result, which should hopefully be that it's taken seriously and something's actually done about these.
I suppose it's quite difficult because a lot of the time when it comes to legal cases, until a precedent is set on a certain thing and a case has actually gone through court and, you know, they've decided, yes, this evidence, we will accept this evidence, and that becomes a kind of landmark ruling in a way, it's difficult to ensure that it definitely will be. And also for all these different international courts all around the world, it's not necessarily the case that they will all see them the same. So it's really good to see this happening on an international cooperation level.
Yeah, because at the same time, the IBA, you know, it's made up of lawyers, bar associations, you know, former judges, I'm sure. So people that will know what will be admissible and what won't be. And it's just, you know, very simple things like journalists, photojournalists, stuff that they take will be admissible in court because you can have people verify it. A lot of the footage that people are putting forward, it can't be verified because you can't find the person who has uploaded it in the first place. So they have to remain anonymous to protect themselves or whatever the case may be.
As a journalist, I mean, it sounds intriguing just purely for what we do as well. I mean, obviously, maybe in tech, it's slightly different than hard news and world news. But, you know, I've been in positions before on our news desks where we're getting in images and videos from all over the world, particularly at that time, Syria. And it was incredibly difficult to verify that footage. Now, obviously, this is specifically for courts, but I think there is also a case for having a file system like this or some version of this where footage which is intended for the public can be checked against that kind of data. I mean, obviously, there are perhaps privacy issues with doing that as standard, but having the option, I think, makes a lot of sense.
Definitely, definitely, because I think there's been so much made of citizen journalism over the past few years. You know, everyone's really big into it. It's really great. You get to find out the truth of what's happening in a place that we don't have access to, where governments are very restrictive on freedom of the press. But actually, a lot of governments use this to their advantage, and they will publicise manipulated footage. Activists will do the same, supporters of the government will do the same. And it has happened quite a lot in the past that, you know, a news organisation has gotten hold of a video and shared it on social media instantly because it, you know, it looks bad for one side or the other, and they've publicised it and it's turned out to be completely fake. It's happened quite a lot between Israelis and Palestinians and throughout various conflicts over the last few years, where both sides accuse each other of faking footage, and both sides have been proven to have faked footage, whether it's their supporters or them doing it. And then it becomes very hard to trust what is a really great resource for spreading the word about things that happened in closed environments and nations. One really important thing I should say about the app is that it's got a secure setting where everything can be wiped or hidden from view if people are captured, which again, in Syria particularly and Egypt, there were a lot of cases of people just being arrested for, you know, looking like they might be filming something. Whether or not they've actually done anything with the content or filmed something was irrelevant. They would just be put in prison.
This is also interesting in context of the news that UK police officers are going to be wearing body cameras increasingly in the future.
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of case for... I think generally the public is aware that we're being watched more and that we don't have the same power. I mean, even when you look in the US and there's been so many cases of, you know, police using excessive force and they've been filmed, but nothing seems to have been done in a lot of instances. That's far more complex. And, you know, the time and date obviously isn't in dispute in the same way these kinds of human rights abuses that this is tackling are. But I think there's like a growing awareness that some people might want to afford themselves the same protection that police seem to be doing.
I mean, the other side of that as well is that often lots has happened because of that kind of footage, particularly in America, but usually it relies on reaching a critical mass in terms of social outrage, you know, generalized outrage at what that video implies. And you know, that was the case all through the 90s with, you know, various high-profile cases of police abuse. And that's the same now. It happens quicker now because of social media. But I suppose what's interesting about this is it gives that video footage more power potentially in the courts as well as in the court of public opinion.
Yeah.
And that is a step change. I suppose, you know, the obvious downside of this is that no system is perfect. And as soon as someone figures out how to fake this, then the whole system gets undermined again.
But you're right, it's interesting because in a lot of these cases, these videos go straight up on YouTube. People's first instinct isn't to send them to the police or send them to a lawyer because they don't believe that there's going to be any real change or impact because they've seen these videos online and nothing seems to have changed beforehand. Whereas if the system, like you say, was, you know, this is important news worth reporting, it went to a journalist. This is important because a crime has happened and I've seen it. It goes straight to a lawyer or a prosecutor.
Yeah, I suppose It's that thing where like it doesn't, a video doesn't necessarily have to go viral for it to be important or sort of life-changing for a person or to have an impact. Like it can just be a thing that's only seen by people who are in a court and who are related to a specific case. It doesn't have to be a viral sensation.
Exactly. But I think people haven't had the faith in the past that that it will have a practical
or the tools. Yeah, the tools to make that happen.
On that note, Katie, on a slightly different note, but significant information on social media is also of concern to government as well as the court of public opinion. And recently, very recently, the government has contracted 7 companies to do that task for them. It sounds slightly insidious, but actually it's also something that's just a spin on something that's been done before.
Mm. So, yeah, this caught my eye. And basically, the government announced last week that it's going to start monitoring social media feeds. So that's Facebook, Twitter, blogs, and it's going to be looking for analysis of them as well. But I was just, my first reaction was, what exactly is it looking for and why? Just to kind of allay any fears, this isn't a mass surveillance project like those kind of ascribed to GCHQ by Edward Snowden and those revelations. What it's trying to do is actually monitor the public opinion, not private opinion of individuals. And it's employed several media companies to do this. And these are companies that do a similar thing for, say, big brands out there and, you know, various things that they are given a task. So they want to, a big company, for example, might want to understand what people think of it and how they're being talked about. And these are those kind of companies that are doing that.
So that's literally what the government is using this for, to find out what the public thinks about it.
Well, I mean, we don't technically know exactly what they're going to do with the information, but looking through the documents that detail these agreements with the companies, we can kind of start to get a glimpse of some of the reasons why. So looking through, it basically says some but not all of these companies will be responsible for scanning social media and looking for keywords and following conversations that matter to the general public. So it will be looking at things like hashtags, specific topics, and also in, say, in there's a crisis situation, a little bit like the London riots or something like that, it will be looking to follow conversations and also to try and see how, you know, the public is viewing the government's response to those events.
But on the flip side, they might actually find out what we care about.
Well, this is the thing. So, I mean, in a sense, you could see this as almost a responsible move. Mm. And, you know, what they are doing is a fairly standard 21st century public relations thing. You know, they are trying to assess what we think of them and if you think about certain policies and that kind of stuff, the idea that they're actually interested in our feedback, yeah, and that they're interested,
good thing.
Yeah, yeah, I mean you'd want that to be the case, surely.
And it's something that parties are all using in the run-up to the general election to some extent.
Well,
like
I think that's an interesting point, in as much as I don't know if the documents have mentioned this, it may be something we could follow up on, but to what extent this stuff becomes public in terms of the analysis they do or the sentiment that they can tell from social media, because not every political party is going to have access to the same scale of information. And, you know, it's arguable that, I mean, Twitter and sentiment analysis was a big thing during the election, but not every party has the money to get the same data, but right? So to what extent does this become about public sentiment towards the government, or, you know, in the run-up an election, does it become about public sentiment towards a political party?
It's kind of like if it's not just for public relations and it's for more good than that, because we're in power and we want to know what you want and then maybe we can help it happen. Or like with the London riots, pretty awkward if you find out from like your teenager that the London riots are going on because it's all over social media. Like they should be actively taking responsibility to some extent for that stuff. But if it's just been used for PR, then, like you say, then there's a worry about the balance between parties.
Another interesting element of it is how they're looking at influencers, which is public relations speak for people who are significant socially and culturally.
That's right. So this really stood out to me. And they refer to them, like you say, Michael, as influencers. And sometimes they refer to them as authors. And in the traditional sense, so if you think of traditional media monitoring, the government might monitor what journalists are saying about the party or the government's policies, for example. But now they're moving beyond just looking at what journalists say. This is open to everyone. So anybody can now be considered an author by the government if they're publishing sentiment on social media, which it's, you know, it's very vague, and it's almost a little bit like, you know, what you were saying with the transparency when it comes to the parties and that kind of thing. It would be good to actually know what and who the government is interested in following on social media.
Surely it's just anyone with a big following that has a lot to say about politics, well, and social.
But it's
society.
Also to do with how far those views are carried elsewhere on social media. So everyone knows you can buy 100,000 followers on Twitter and appear significant, but if no one's actually reading what you say, all those people are bots, then you're not necessarily going to be someone of importance. But Russell Brand is someone who is not a traditional journalist. He's a comedian, actor, revolutionary, according to him. But, you know, he is an influencer and someone the government would want to monitor in the same way as they would have once wanted to monitor a journalist.
And the requirements for this within the documents say that that there should be a specific tool that can, you know, identify these influencers and then monitor them. It says the tool shall identify influencers through recognised influencer scores. I presume that doesn't mean clout.
I think it may.
Which is concerning. And not simply follower numbers. The supplier, that's the company that it's contracting this job out to, shall integrate the latest influencer advancements in the industry into the tools, such as authority and human filtration. Now, we don't actually know what the government's criteria for being an influencer is, and you know, it could extend from anybody that's, you know, from a prolific journalist to a celebrity to somebody who may be stirring dissent or bad feeling towards certain policies, towards or somebody who might be whistleblowing or exposing.
You think they're going to lock them up then?
Well, I think what concerns me about this is the way that this tool and the lack of transparency might interact with other legislation and other kind of tools that the government uses. So if you think about the Snoopers Charter and the way that that might allow the government to access to kind of people's information, and if you're identified as an author, is that just in the context of your social media, or will then you become a subject of interest for the government elsewhere?
Oh, I see what you think. They're identifying people that they'll want to investigate further.
Well, I think it's possible, and but the problem is that there's no transparency over this.
I feel a Freedom of Information Act request coming on.
Well, I believe it will probably be subject to that, and yeah, that would be an interesting thing to see.
It will be, and if they suddenly start saying red flags, we can't show you this, then your question will be answered.
I think the other side of it, though, is that it's just another reminder of how much information is already public. You know, a lot of the story on monitoring of internet communications has focused on private information for obvious reasons, and that's a really important topic. But the amount of information people are putting out about themselves publicly is also vast, and it's completely natural that a government or any company would want to monitor that. But I think you have to be aware when you are putting that information out, you are making yourself subject to that kind of investigation by default. And to some extent, outrage over that kind of surveillance, I don't have so much sympathy for it. Yeah. You have actively made the choice to put this out in the public. If you had a public blog and you were writing about a local government issue, you might explicitly want government to read it, or you might not, but it's really not down to you. And if you're participating in that public forum, then you're subject to, you know, someone deciding if you're important or not, or passing that information on elsewhere. But it'd be interesting to monitor this and kind of get some more details as these kind of contracts spill out or more information becomes available. But it's certainly concerning.
I think you're right, Michael, in that, you know, technically we can all be publishers now, and we can all put information out into the public domain, and ultimately if we don't want people reading that and judging that and making and analyzing who we are and what we think, then the obvious answer to that is to put privacy, you know, to put privacy blocks on our social media accounts. But there is the other thing which concerns me, which is more to do with like people who publish things anonymously. So there are lots of people out there who might not use Twitter using their real name, or they might not necessarily, or they might have a well-read blog that they don't publish under their own name. And to what extent, if they're identified as an author, are they going to be protected from, you know,
I think further investigation? Based on the terms of that we've outlined here, they wouldn't be necessarily subject to this because they wouldn't be public, or I mean they wouldn't necessarily link their private and public information. You can't be sure that isn't happening somewhere, but at the same time that doesn't seem to be covered by this. I guess I just mean that, you know, there's a certain amount of hypocrisy in being irritated that the government are tracking what you say or, you know, other information about you if you're at the same time uploading photos of your private life with geotagged information that also outline your address and, you know, your mother's maiden name or whatever it is. You know, there's a certain amount that in giving up that information consciously, you're also making yourself subject to wider scrutiny, and that more awareness of that transaction, and it is a transaction, both with the companies who provide you that service and the government that, you know, controls the other elements of your life, arguably, you know, you're subject to that. So be aware of what you put out on the internet is generally a good line. Well, that's all the news this week. Still to come, Apple has news of its own on everything from iOS to the Apple Watch. Our reaction to all of these big announcements coming up.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
So guys, this week on the tech blogs was dominated by Apple because Apple had an announcement at WWDC, its annual developers conference. Traditionally more of a software operating system APIs led announcement, but there was some consumer stuff in there too, and it was pretty significant. So why don't we just kind of run through some of the big announcements one by one and see what we all think of them. I mean, the big one arguably was Apple Music. Finally, Apple has entered the world of streaming music, only 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years after everyone else, with a service called Apple Music. Not tremendously entertaining or innovative in terms of its name, but no. You know, there it is, Apple Music, and it's pretty much what we expected.
Yeah, so we've been waiting for this for a little while, and it all started, I think, when Apple bought Beats, the Dr. Dre's music technology empire, and bought that into the fold. And the suspicion was that it wasn't interested particularly in the hardware side, which I think is true and remains true to this day, pretty much. But what they were interested in was the Beats streaming service, which they have kind of taken on board and rebranded and fiddled with and Apple-ified it.
So this is £10 a month-ish. We're not quite sure on the exact pricing yet. Gets you access to 30 million plus, I think 37 million, plus tracks, including Taylor Swift, who isn't appearing on too many other services. Mm-hmm. So you get free streaming and offline listening of those. You get access to a new 24-hour global radio station called Beats One, headlined by Zane Lowe, which the world needed.
Yeah,
another way to listen to Zane Lowe, so that exists. And also Kinect, which is essentially Ping reborn. Ping, if you don't remember, was Apple's prior attempt at creating a social network for music, giving you access to the artists you like and their backstage videos.
And, so it's kind of a PR channel for musicians.
Well, yeah, I mean, but it's also material that exists on every other, you know, it exists on YouTube and it exists on Instagram or Twitter. I mean, if you really like a band and you want to get backstage access to that band or more, you can do that in 1,000 different places. But anyway, that's built into this system too. And obviously iTunes or Apple Music is still selling music.
So either than combining your music libraries easily, what's What's the big sell here?
Well, one of them is that it's built into the OS, and that's arguably for Apple the most significant thing. Mm. So, you know,
but for a consumer.
Well, so Siri is integrated into it. Okay. So, if you're in your car and you're using CarPlay, or just your iPhone plugged in with a headphone jack, you can call out to Siri. She'll be able to find music through this system and easily play it back to you in an integrated way. It's one single app. You don't have to sign up anywhere else. Or all the payments are controlled through your credit card. You can also do family sharing for, I think, $15 a month. Which, again, don't have the UK price. And that enables you to share one account between all of your family, which arguably is cheaper than the Spotify equivalent.
One thing that really interests me and actually quite shocked me, I must say, during the announcement, was that it will also be available on Android.
Yes.
Which is unprecedented.
That was probably the only thing that surprised me of the announcement. And I thought they're really gunning for it here.
Yeah,
if they hadn't done that, they wouldn't be in the competition.
It's wise, because although there are some people that are completely locked into the Apple operating system, there are other people that may use different devices, and you know, if they're switching between devices, or if they've got an iPhone but a Nexus tablet, or you know, especially if you're taking advantage of one of these family deals and not all of your family are using Apple products, then it's going to be the important thing. Like that would be a thing that would stand in the way of people signing up. And I think Apple quite wisely here have decided that they are not going to punish Android users for not necessarily using Apple hardware all the time.
So I think it's fair to say, though, that the reaction to this was relatively muted amongst tech journalists, many of whom are probably using Spotify for free with free codes provided by the PR agency, but that's to one side. You know, it's not something that necessarily is full of new features that we haven't seen before. It's not reinventing streaming music. It's essentially, you know, we're also here, we're also doing this thing. And, you know, there are only 15 million people currently paying for Spotify, and there are hundreds of millions of people with iPhones. It makes sense for Apple to be in this space. I don't think necessarily they need it to be the world's biggest hit right off the bat. You know, I think they're making a lot of money selling iPhones, and that this was an obvious thing they lacked, and now they have it. But it's right off the bat, it's not the most exceptionally innovative take on this we've seen. It's just more kind of significant for the fact that it exists at all.
Do we understand that they're being nice to artists then if Taylor signed up?
Well, I think they are.
Fair.
And I think one of the interesting things as well is that they're not just interested in promoting established artists. Like, there was a big emphasis there on bringing in unsigned artists and making it a platform for anybody that's making music, basically, which, you know, is another thing that they're going to have to do, because it's one of those things that its rivals have already been doing. You know, they're introducing new ways to discover new music, and you know, this kind of like discoverability feature is something that Spotify in particular has really been playing up recently, and it's its big sell almost. So you know, it's going to, in order to make sure that it's appealing both to consumers and to artists, it's going to need to make sure that it's a kind of fair play platform, and also, you know, it must be in terms of the deals that it has with the artists, you know, to ensure that it has people like Taylor Swift on the service, it must be giving them a fairly good deal as well. And you know, I suspect in order to get some of the exclusive content that they will want for the Connect service, you know, they might be offering incentives for bigger artists to use that exclusively as well. I mean, that's just a theory, but I suspect that they will do that because they want to promote it.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I think obviously exclusives are going to be a big part of this. I think the radio station, they're seeing it as a big part of the exclusivity as well, and trying to create a global conversation around music. To some extent, it remains to be seen. I mean, one obvious thing is that there's no free tier. So unlike Spotify, you can't listen for free. You can listen to, I think, the radio station for free, but there's a free three-month trial, but no free tier for the service. So whether or not that's going to be enough to transition people away from enduring Spotify ads in order to get free music, we don't know. So let's run through some of the other big announcements. iOS 9 is coming. Relatively slight update, but some bigger updates for the iPad. So you can now multitask more easily. You can run split screen if you have the latest iPad Air 2 and have a messaging service swipe in from the right while you're browsing. So that was fairly significant. Mac OS 10 is also getting an update, although it's, again, focusing on multitasking and a lot of it's snapping windows to different sides of the screen. Seemed pretty heavily influenced by Windows, but, you know, whether or not they'll ever admit that, I very much doubt it. But, again, a relatively minor in terms of visual updates and features. But then the Apple Watch had a lot of significant news attached.
Yeah, so it's actually only been 6 weeks since the Apple Watch went on sale, which it seems much longer in my head, but they're already announcing the Watch OS 2 update, which will be coming later this year. And probably the most significant part of that was they are introducing native apps to the Apple Watch, which is going to give developers a lot more freedom, and it's going to mean that the Apple Watch relies less on the iPhone for being, you know, an exciting standalone product that, you know, people will be able to kind of take advantage of fully on their wrist, as opposed to the watch just being an accessory for the iPhone.
So native apps running on the watch's processor rather than running on the phone and just sending updates to the watch. And you know, I guess fitness is one of those things that will be significant for. So Strava, which is the cycling tracking app, will be able to run on the watch itself rather than on the phone. So you can leave your phone at home and just go out with your watch. I think they also said the watch will accept updates from Wi-Fi networks it's familiar with, even when it doesn't have your phone in your pocket. Mm. Android Wear also introduced that feature very recently. But that, again, is something that could make the watch more significant. If you go for a run and you happen to run past Costa Coffee or whatever it is, and you have the Wi-Fi network in your thing, you might get updates from your phone.
Mm. And there's also another feature that is in a similar vein. It's something called Complications, which allows developers to create kind of watch faces that have extra information on and deliver you information straight away when you go to your watch home screen, I suppose you could call it. And I think having used the Apple Watch and used the Glances feature a lot, I would say this is probably going to be quite significant when it actually comes to using those features of the Apple Watch that you want to use frequently. You know, on a day-to-day basis. I also really like some of the new Apple Watch faces updates that they're introducing. And it strikes me as strange that they didn't actually have this before, but they're going to now let you use photos from your photo album on your iPhone. And you can even choose a whole album and have the photos kind of scrolling through, which is a nice feature. It's an obvious thing, really, that they should probably have done in the first place. And they've also got these really, really nice time-lapse watch faces that will let you see kind of where you are, and it will, you know, provide, say if you're in London, you'll get a picture of London at different times of day, and that kind of also sort of relates to the fact that you'll now be able to play videos on the watch as well, like you'll be able to stream them from your iPhone. Another feature that they introduced was Timeline, which seems like a good use for the digital crown, which I found myself sort of almost forgetting about. I use it as a button on the Apple Watch, but actually forget to use it for scrolling quite a lot of the time. And what it will let you do is it will let you kind of fast forward through your diary, and it will provide you with information about all of the things that are in your diary and what the weather is supposed to be like at that particular time, the temperature, or lots of other different things about the watch or about your schedule as you kind of scroll back and forth through time.
So Watch OS 2 will be out in the autumn, or the fall, if you obviously watch Apple's announcements, along with iOS 9 and Mac OS 10.11, El Capitan, which is the name. Good choice there. There are obviously lots more announcements. Swift, Apple's programming language, is going open source. That's very neat. There's a lot more interesting healthcare information that we may dig into later this week, including tracking reproductive health, which is a good thing, I think, and widely called for, and lots of other stuff. But we have some very wide coverage on the website. So
there's also the story specifically for UK users that Apple Pay will be coming to the UK, which is about time too, I'd say.
Obviously, you can use it on the London Tube. And it turns out, actually, American users have been able to use the Apple Watch on the London Tube for a long time. Yeah.
Well, already. I mean,
they're getting charged, actually.
I did a really like in-depth interview with TfL last year, and they explained to me how they completely redesigned the payment system across the whole of the TfL network, and they've been ready for this. They saw this coming, and they've been ready to accept pretty much any form of contactless payment that anyone wants to use.
Go TfL.
Yeah.
The only, I think, the only major bank missing from Apple Pay at launch is Barclays, which I'm sure has nothing to do with the fact that Barclays has its own mobile payment system that it's trying to flog. But yeah, more details on Apple Pay and everything that Apple announced on the website. Just time for some feedback now. Last week we discussed gaming and the future of video games ahead of E3. Where are we heading next week? So we had one at least suggestion for a game we should check out, which was coming to us from CH Ford. He says, I know you didn't mention it, but you've been looking for a game which VR adds something to. May I recommend Elite Dangerous? Good call. I've played Elite Dangerous in VR, and it is excellent. Anyway, he goes on, I've been playing this game since the alpha release, where it could be used with the Oculus Rift DK1 and DK2. The game is very good. The latest Dream version is a dream come true, in my humble opinion. And he says, essentially, it gives you a very immersive feeling virtual reality experience in space in your own spaceship. And I agree, it's very cool. And Oculus Rift will be unveiling something as we record this tomorrow. It's on Thursday, so all of that information should be online by the time you listen to the podcast. However, there was one criticism, which is that we didn't explicitly mention PC gaming. And that, again, is a good call. Asker Anderson Hoiby writes, I had one big thought on your coverage in gaming. Where was the PC? All your thoughts about the small indie scene versus the multi-million productions are beautifully displayed on a service called Steam. I think we all know Steam. I'm a user, obviously. But he writes, I'm not corporate or anything, just a consumer. But on Steam, you have GTA 5 that goes for €60 right next to a totally unknown game for €1. The PC gaming community is one of the most exciting, influential and fastest growing. Or, more precisely, they've always been there. But the interest in PCs and PC gaming has been rising a lot lately, which is an excellent point. I think sometimes we can get a little bit too focused on consoles, and it's right to call out PC gaming.
And I suppose as well, PC gaming is, I think, more accessible to a lot of people that perhaps don't want to invest in consoles, because the likelihood is that even if you don't have access to a console, you will have access to a PC. And, you know, that might not be a PC that's capable of running those really intensive games, but for some of the less intensive games, it's a kind of an access point, I guess, for people who perhaps are, you know, want to try out gaming or and don't want to have to spend money on an Xbox or a PlayStation to do so.
That's true, and the cost is always something that people bring up in relation to PC gaming, because the entry cost can be quite high. On the other hand, they tend to last for a very long time, because you only update certain components as you go. And ultimately, if it's a hobby you get into and make the initial investment, even those higher end games can be, you know, relatively inexpensive in the long term. So, you know, it's not just as simple as being three times the cost of a console. So we will specifically look out for some PC gaming stuff at this year's E3 alongside all the big console announcements. So again, check the website for that. So that's all for this week. We'll see you again next week.
Cheerio.
Bye.